I was just thinking about all the ways that in my my career that we've gotten people's attention, you know, to get them back in the room. When I was 17, I got to co-found a camp called Camp Tawanga, which is still in existence. And we did this. You know, you put your fingers up like this, the kids would come in, they'd be quiet, or... And then there were other situations where you'd knock people's heads together to get them back. You're so cooperative, though. So all I have to do is to ring this little bell. So first of all, I want to just thank Howie for inviting me. He's one of my favorite people in the whole world. And somebody who I love to learn from. It's rare to meet Dharma teachers who have the kind of brilliant sense of humor and intelligence and warmth that he does, that he has. So I feel very honored to be sitting on a stage where he would normally be. So the subject that I thought about a lot is the Dharma of work. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of distinctions that are made in different lineages of Buddhism. One of the distinctions that's made is meditation on the cushion and then post-meditation. And it's kind of an interesting and, in my mind, an artificial distinction. In Zen practice, the distinction would not be made. There would be that you're present on the pillow, and then you're present cooking, and then you're present walking. Wherever you are, it's all a practice of awareness. But some environments are very conducive to doing practice. And the reason why they're conducive is because they're so difficult. And I think that the subject of how meditation practice enhances or integrates with the experience of doing anything where there's a sense of accomplishment or a goal or result is a very interesting place to begin to kind of explore. And I want to make sure that the definition of work doesn't get restricted to working for money. One way that I've heard this discussed is that the difference between work and love is that love is the experience of being with, whereas work is the kind of seeking after something or having a goal or an intention. And so you could have a goal or an intention to chop vegetables very, very, very effectively, like really with a great deal of precision. Or you could see work as being the kind of cleaning up after the detritus of life, you know, the maintenance of life. But many of us are familiar with the experience of trying to make a living in whatever form that is. And just out of curiosity, how many of you consciously and intentionally bring your practice? And when I say practice, I don't mean just the sitting practice, but I'm talking about the practice of bringing the Dharma or bringing the principles into your work life. Consciously do that. Great. So for those of you who already are doing that, my hope is that I will enhance and add to some ways that you might consider that. And for those of you that have not given that much thought or maybe haven't considered that that's a great place to practice, I'd like to introduce that idea. It was January, and it was a very, very bitter and cold winter in Illinois. And I had flown in from San Francisco to Chicago and then drove about 2.5 hours to a little town in central Illinois, which houses the Green Giant Cream Corn Factory. Now, how many of you remember cream corn? How many of you still love it? So, as you near the town, well, as you're driving, all that you see is corn stubble. And it's gray, black corn stubble. And it goes on for miles and miles and miles and miles. That's all you see. It's just this, you know, stubble and gray. And you come into the town, and the tallest building in the town is a hotel that has a 3-story clock tower. So if anybody wants to know, like, where the best place is to see the town, you go to the clock tower. And so first morning that we arrive, we're a bunch of consultants, and our job there is we're doing a supervision class for managers. And the plant manager says, we'd love to take you around. We really want to show you the plant. And so you can get within 2 miles of the plant, you know it's there. The sickening sweet smell of Green Giant cream corn permeates the entire town. And so you get used to that after a while. It doesn't even bother you that much. And so we go on this tour. And we get to a conveyor belt, and there's thousands and thousands and thousands of cans of cream corn that are flying by. And there's a kind of middle-aged to elderly Japanese woman who's about 4'7", and she's standing right at the conveyor belt, and she's pulling out dented cans so that they don't end up in your shopping cart. And we stopped at her station, and the guy who was giving us the tour introduced us to her, and he said, she's been doing this for 47 years. That, just exactly what we were watching her do. And me and my judgmental mind, I immediately went to, poor woman. And so luckily, we were able to talk with her afterwards in the cafeteria. And so I asked her, I said, so what's that like for you? What's that like for you to be, you know, doing this day in and day out? She said, oh, I love it. She said, I just love it. She said, what she was describing was that she gets into a flow state. You know, she's just one with the cans. And for her, there's no time. You know, the lunch whistle goes off, and she goes, oh, my God, 4 hours went by. And then the, you know, dinner bell goes off, or the evening bell, and it's time to leave. And she goes, okay, well, I can come back tomorrow. And it was really eye-opening for me. It was eye-opening in a couple of different ways. One was that it was one of the few and first times that I had illustrated what it's like when somebody is completely present with whatever they're doing. It made no difference to her what it was that she was doing. She was simply giving her full undivided attention. And by the way, these cans go by very quickly, and to be able to get the dented cans out of there requires quite a bit of eye-hand coordination. You can get hurt if you don't get it right. So there's a little bit of risk that's associated, but you figure by 47 years, she probably has got it down, and it probably doesn't break her fingers very often doing that. But she didn't need that to be able to give it her full undivided attention. She was practicing mindfulness, and probably if you had done a study of her brainwaves, you'd find out that she had more focused concentration than 99% of the people on the planet. You know, that's just what she had brought. That was her practice. And so, you know, one of the things that to me is very important is that there's no distinction that everything that you experience in your life is part of your practice. It's part of the Dharma. And sometimes it's very difficult to remember that because the predisposition in Western Buddhism is that there's the pillow and that's the practice. And there's not as much of an emphasis on how is practice done once you leave the pillow. And so I'd like to begin to kind of address some of the ways that we might do that. So here's one quote from the Buddha. He said, "Your work is to discover your work and then give your whole heart to it." Your work is to discover your work and then give your whole heart to it. So there's many different ways that work is central in Buddhism. So one example of its centrality is in the teachings on right livelihood. And there are very clear kind of distinctions about what is and isn't right livelihood. And really, in some ways, the importance about right livelihood, in my mind at least, is that it has integrity for you. That there's a way in which you feel that you're able to bring, as the Buddha said, that you're able to bring your whole heart to it. Another kind of central theme in Buddhism is right view, which I think basically means finding a way of looking at something that is wholesome and that encourages mindfulness, that encourages awareness. And so let's just take right view for a moment. So how many of you have ever been in a situation where you've been working and found yourself complaining about others during or after? Yeah. So is there a way in which complaining is right view? What do you think? How many of you would say, yeah, complaining is right view as long as it's done with right view, right? What about that? What about complaining? What about gossiping? You know, are those examples of right view? Well, the only way that you can really make the comparison is by kind of asking the question, what's the alternative? There's a practice in Tibetan Buddhism which has been popularized by the Zen teacher Norman Fisher. It's called Lojong. Any of you been exposed to Lojong? Know anything about Lojong? So Lojong is a set of 59 slogans. They're very short phrases that are used as meditation objects. And they build on each other. So the way that you can use the slogans is to carry one with you and kind of keep referring to it. So here's an example of a slogan. One of the slogans is, bring everything on the path. Carry everything on the path. And so one of the ways that carrying everything on the path translates for me is in the examination of complaining. Because when you start unpacking a complaint, often what's inside of it is a sense of victimization. Somebody did something to me and it was unfair. Or the organization, my wife, the kids, did something and they were unjust, unfair, they didn't really understand me, and I'm really upset about it. Now, if you bring that onto the path, so what I'm doing is I'm just saying, here are some ways that you can bring your practice into everyday life in those places where you rub up against individuals, relationships, organizations. So if you bring that on the path, then there's no room for complaint. doesn't mean that you wouldn't acknowledge that you'd really love to gossip about them, and that you could, if you really got into it, you could probably find five to seven people who would be happy to agree with you about what a dunce they are. And then you could have collusion about that, and you could really develop a very, very proliferated sense of complaint that would be justified in a court of law. But what it would do is it wouldn't add to your wholesomeness, and it wouldn't really teach you much. And if what practice is the experience of having an open mind and a desire to learn from everything, then in some ways, and I'll just speak for myself, I can't afford to complain. It's really a waste of my time and my energy. It would be much better to ask the question, if I were to apply my practice to this particular situation, what could I learn from it? And so one way that you can transform judgment, criticism, evaluation of others, is that you can begin to use that kind of checklist that we have in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. If this entire practice of Vipassana is built on the Satipatthana Sutta, and that sutta is about the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, then you could take with you the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and you could bring it into every situation, and you could transform the situation immediately from something where you feel victimized or hurt, or that there's something wrong with the situation, and all of a sudden it can potentially become very right, because where your attention has shifted is away from the kind of concocting of a story about someone who did you wrong, or an organization that you did you wrong, or a government that did you wrong, and you can pull it back here, and you can say, so what emotional tone do I have right now about this experience? Pretty unpleasant. This is a very unpleasant situation. Or it's very pleasant, or it's neutral. And so what begins to happen is that when you start asking about emotional tone as one of the four foundations, it moves your attention down deep. And you can settle kind of into your own being and not end up wasting your energy. Or another example might be, so with regard to this situation, what physical sensations are going on right now? So with regard to my relationship with this person or with this situation, what am I aware of with regard to physical sensations? Well, I notice that there's a real tightening in my chest. I notice that my arms are contracted. I notice that I have fists that are balled. I notice that my breathing is shallow. And as you process the mindfulness of sensation, what begins to happen is that the tendency towards kind of dissipating your energy in complaint begins to build within you as awareness. Or, if you're at all psychologically oriented, which I certainly am, you can also begin to look at, well, with regard to this situation, have I ever been here before? Is this a pattern? Do I have a habit of making some people really wrong while others I elevate? You know, what do I have a pattern here of deferring and not speaking up? This is called mindfulness of dharmas, mindfulness of the kind of patterns of the mind. And it's a very, very fruitful area with regard to work, because in my experience, and just to say a little bit about my experience, I've spent 50 years since I was 17 working in companies, whether they were not-for-profits or for-profit, and almost always in the position of being a organizational observer, which, by the way, is not a, it's well paid, but it's not a particularly enjoyable experience because you're always the outsider and you're always saying things nobody wants to hear. It's like being a therapist in some ways, or sometimes it's like being a mother or father. You know, you're the one who's going to point to the things that are in the unconscious. But I think that one thing I could say pretty for sure is that work is one of these environments where our family of origin dynamics have a field day. Now, here's the situation where you work with people for a period of time, and it's not uncommon that people begin to recreate their family. And then you get to be mindful of, well, what's the role that you're playing in this situation? You know, how old are you in this particular situation? Are you acting out the way that you did when you were an adolescent? Have you projected onto somebody that they're your father? So the point I'm making is, first of all, let me just say I am not encouraging anyone to judge themselves for having these kinds of reactions. Instead, what I'm really encouraging is that we expand our kind of definition of where our practice can be used, and to consider that the work environment or any work situation is just filled with the opportunities. And part of the reason why it's so filled with opportunities is because usually when people are in situations where they're working, the stakes are fairly high. Like the stake of keeping it, keeping your job, or the stake of wanting to look good, the stake of wanting to improve your situation in life, the stake of having people who you care about and who care about you. So it's just filled with these incredible rivers or currents of opportunity to practice. Let me just stop for a second. I just want to check in with the time. So one very specific way that you can bring your practice into the world and off the cushion is by bringing mindfulness into any situation that you find yourself in where you would consider that to be work. And there are many, many examples of ways people do this that are very simple. Very, very simple, very direct. I was talking to a colleague, and I had asked her the same question, like, how do you use your practice at work? And she said that one of the most direct ways was to use her breathing as a way of beginning to slow down her reaction time. That one of the characteristics of high-pressure situations or situations where the stakes are high are that it's also an opportunity to put your foot in your mouth a lot, to say things that you wished you hadn't said, or to not say things that you wished you would have said. If you can slow your reaction time down, and you can do that through mindfulness of the breath, then here's a tool that gives you that kind of space between what it is that you might want to say and whether or not you do that, and then what it is that you would say if you actually were in your right mind. So breathing is one way of doing that. One last kind of way of applying practice is mindfulness of the body. I'm old enough to be to have the memory of being told when I started out my career in my early 20s, having a manager say to me, "You leave your body at the door." He said, we're only paying you for your mind. I mean, he was serious. And I think that that bias about the abdication of the body is very much a part of the work culture that people find themselves in now. And it doesn't preclude having the same dynamic if you work for a living with your body, because if you really paid attention to what your body was experiencing, you might work differently. You might work with a different kind of consciousness about the way that you were standing or the way that you were moving. But I can tell you that once you begin to make a commitment and say, my intention is for the next week to bring mindfulness of the body into those situations where I normally don't pay any attention at all. And very quickly, you begin to notice that you're sitting way too much. Very quickly, you begin to notice that it's been 2 hours since you took a breath. You know, very quickly, you notice that you have lost track of whether your body's hungry or whether or not you've had a sip of water. And these are things that you have direct control over. You have direct control over whether or not you're mindful of your body and then how you act on that mindfulness. There's a one observation working inside of organizations is that organizations create a lot of suffering. Human systems create suffering because they're made up of us. But you get 2-3 people together, even if they're friends, and it becomes political. I was thinking about, I watched the first hour of the movie, the biopic Jobs, about Steve Jobs. And it's a wonderful example of what can happen when people who are, in quotes, friends, are affected by greed and by aversion and delusion. And if you're mindful of the body, then one of the things that happens is that you begin to also be mindful of emotion. And you can begin to see kind of how emotion is affecting you in situations, and that through that you can make more conscious choices. So let me just stop for a moment about mindfulness. And there's two other subjects that I wanted to explore briefly with you about practice and work. I'm very, very interested in the research that's being done around mindfulness and the workplace. And one area that there's an enormous amount of interest is in how does compassion affect people in the workplace. I had the good fortune of working with a woman who's been researching this subject for 40 years, Jane Dutton. And there are just this huge proliferation of studies that demonstrate three things. Number one is that human beings are naturally compassionate. That, you know, kind of the view that we're, that by our nature that we're competitive and that we tend to always be looking for the angle or for the edge, that what's more natural to human beings, that's what's wired in the brain, is that we're kind and that we love. And that we really love to be good to each other. And these studies that have been done, which are very, very kind of highly academic studies with a great deal of rigor, show that the person who's the receiver of compassionate action in the workplace, and it could be for something really simple. A friend of mine who is a colleague on Monday mentioned that she'd had a really difficult weekend. And, you know, my natural reaction to that was to explore it a little bit, you know, ask her a question, kind of, you know, see if there's anything that she wanted to say about that. And when I left the interaction and I just stopped for a moment, I thought about how natural that is to want to relieve the suffering of another person. I mean, it could be very, very, very minor. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, something major, just something like, well, I had an argument with my husband, you know, and it's kind of still staying with me right now. Or, you know, my kids and I are really not getting along very well. Or I went to a movie and it really triggered me, really upset me, and I'm still upset about it. It doesn't matter. What's important is the response. And that's the second area that they've been doing research on is how beneficial, not just to the recipient, but how incredibly beneficial compassion is to the one who offers it. And the third is that when compassion is present, that human beings want to be in that environment. Of course, the flip side is also true, that when you work in places where it's not compassionate, but it's hostile and aggressive, human beings don't want to be in places like that, and that it's very difficult to stay there. So a second place that we can bring our practice is that we can be kind. We can look for opportunities where we can practice kindness. I mean, I think that the thing that drew me into Buddhism probably initially was hearing the Dalai Lama, when asked what his religion was, he said, you know, my religion is kindness. And this is not a person who takes that lightly. You know, he's very serious about being kind to every human being that he encounters. And what I'm proposing is aspirational. You know, it's something to aspire to. It's not something that we're going to be good at. It's just something that we want to be as good at it as we can possibly be good at. One of the, in the Lojong practice, the Lojong practice is the cultivation of what's called bodhicitta. So bodhicitta is the state of mind of one who aspires to the state of being a Buddha. And anybody can aspire to be a Buddha. I think that when you set foot in a meditative practice, that in some ways you kind of are already declaring. You may not have really thought of it in that way, but the practice of bodhicitta is the cultivation of compassion. So these 59 slogans are all designed to get yourself out of the way, to get your ego out of the way, to get your selfing out of the way, and to really put your attention on the importance of taking care of others. And one of the slogans which has been particularly meaningful to me, especially within a work context, is drive all blames into one. So the slogan is, drive all blames into one. And the commentary is that for the sake of kindness, for the sake of compassion, stop blaming others. Take it on. Make that your practice. Don't find fault with others. If you want to find fault with yourself. Now, within a Judeo-Christian context, that's a very dangerous thing to say, because we live in an extremely judgmental, harsh culture that tends to kind of take these things to the extreme, and it becomes mea culpa, and it becomes, you know, all of the things that have ever happened to you in your life, and isn't it true? Yes, it really was my fault. But the way that the commentary is talked about in the slogan is that you're doing this for the sake of kindness and love towards others, that they already hate themselves. They already have more than enough judgment. They don't need yours. and that what you're doing is you're stopping the violence, you're stopping the round of, well, if you hadn't, I wouldn't have. And instead, you're just saying, you know what? You're right. I could have done better. I could have been more conscious. I could have handled that differently. And if you can do that in a genuine way, where it comes out of a real sense of authenticity, like you really are interested in like how you could have been better, then it doesn't cause any harm to you, and it causes no harm to anyone else. I was in the pool area of the gym that I go to, and I had a pinched nerve in my back, and like this is the first week that I've been pain free in a month, and one of the ways that I solved the kind of constant dealing with pain was that I discovered that if I went into the pool and kicked, that would really loosen up my back and keep my things from locking up. And so I had gotten into the pool, and I was holding on to the stairs and kicking. And a woman older than me came up to the stairs, and I wasn't finished with my routine. I wasn't finished with my time. I had like 8 minutes to go. And she looked at me, and she said, "I'm going to be kicking it on those stairs." I said, "Good. I'll be finished in about 8 minutes." She looked at me and she said, "I'll be kicking on those stairs now." Anger arose. Irritability arose. Injustice arose. And so what I did was I half-heartedly gave her the pool and said, "Okay, all right," and left. Over the course of my life, I would not have thought twice about that. I would have just, that's what would have happened, and then I would have gone on. And as I was walking to the locker room, I thought to myself, that really was not kind. You did not handle that in a kind way. You did not do that graciously. And you better file that one away and do better next time. Now, so that for me, that's an example of drive all blames into one. It wasn't about her approach. It wasn't her pushiness that I focused on. It was my own reaction to that, which left something to be desired. So the second area that you can bring your practice into work is in the area of compassion and kindness. And the third is the one that has, in some ways, the least conversation going on about it, but I guarantee you that within the next 5 years that it'll begin to replace mindfulness as one of the kind of cultural norms that people will be studying. And that is focused attention. So in Buddhist practice, there is a triangle of practice. And the triangle is sila, which is ethics, morality. And then vipassana, which is insight. And then the third is shamatha. Sometimes it's known as samadhi. And what it means is the tranquility of mind. And tranquility of mind is cultivated through deep, focused concentration. So if you go to a concentration retreat, we do these at Spirit Rock, they're 9 days long, and for 9 days you learn how to bring your full undivided attention to an object, whether the object is external or internal. And concentration practice differs from vipassana in that in vipassana, you're noting moment-to-moment change. Breath, aware of breath, aware of mind, aware of sensation. In shamatha practice, it's called the short leash approach. So if you have a dog and you know what it's like to have the dog on the short leash, that's the way you relate to your mind. No, you're not going anywhere. Right back. So you just keep on bringing yourself back to the object of attention. And so here's a great way to bring practice, because here's this whole body of knowledge called shamatha that you can apply to anything that you're doing that requires concentration, and most things do. And so you could just say, okay, for the next 3 months, I'm going to practice shamatha, concentration practice, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick a couple of things that I do every day, and I'm going to bring my full undivided attention to that, and I'm not going to let my mind wander, and I'm not going to plan, and I'm not going to revisit what happened yesterday. I'm just going to keep on bringing back to chopping, 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 or being with the dog and just paying attention to walking and walking the dog, or talking with a loved one, and instead of letting your mind wander off to everything that you would like to do instead of what you're doing right now, you just keep on bringing your mind right back to the breath, bring it right back to this person who's in front of you. And that as you do that, as you get really, really good at concentrating on each task, you are also training your mind to be able to apply that same kind of quality of attention to anything. Doesn't matter. It's the same quality of attention. And then if you get really good at it, what you can begin to do is you can use concentration practice to pull yourself away from those things that you shouldn't be giving your attention to. And I'm not defining what it is that would be the case for you, but you know. You know the things that take you away from being mindful. You know the things that take you away from being compassionate. You know the things that take you away from feeling like a good person. And the same practice of concentration can be used in two different ways. One is to place your attention and to keep it there indefinitely. And the second is to move your attention away from something and put it somewhere else. So, three different ways that you can apply practice post-meditation, off the cushion. One is mindfulness, and all of the four different ways that we build foundation, we cultivate a foundation of mindfulness. The second is through the practice of compassion. I recommend very strongly to you the book by Norman Fisher, who's a Zen priest, called Lojong, and it's also the cultivation of compassion. And then the third is the area of applying shamatha to daily life. And if you want to read a wonderful book on this subject that's by a layperson, Dan Goleman's book, Focused Attention, it's called Focused, and it's about bringing attention to everyday tasks and what the research says about that. So I think we're pretty close to 9. How do you end around here? We sing Kumbaya, or do we have a group hug? Or why don't we sit just for a minute? May the mindful awareness that we all brought into this room and that we all cultivated together during our time together be of benefit to all sentient beings. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah.
harder from that posture.